The future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope. Bringing the nation back. One photo at a time. This is Aaron McCready.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I am Aaron McCready. I've got a fabulous show for you today. Of course, tomorrow is the third and final presidential debate, and we are all looking forward to that, I know. It is going to be covering foreign affairs, and to some people here in the U.S., some of our citizens, foreign affairs, it doesn't mean a whole lot. But with my next guest, and we're going to talk about China, and then later on in the show, we'll have another guest on. We're talking about the Middle East. You know, you're going to realize how important foreign affairs really are and how important it is that your president of the United States can lay a plan out for national security, for foreign affairs, and to make sure that we stay on track and keep this country safe. But my next guest is editor-in-chief of the New York Analysis of Policy and Government, covering both national and international matters. He's also co-host of the radio program And Nothing But the Truth. He's also columnist for several newspapers and web news services, and he's also a former member of both Republican and Democrat administrations in New York State, including running the Manhattan Workers' Compensation Board in the aftermath of 9/11. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Frank Vernuccio. Frank, welcome to the show.
Aaron, it's great to be with you this afternoon.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. And, you know, as you know, and as I just said, we have the final presidential debate tomorrow, and it is covering foreign affairs. You know, how much attention do you think, and you know quite a bit about China, how much attention do you think that the moderator and the two candidates are, how much attention is China going to receive?
Unfortunately, not a great deal. You know, the story of China's rise in the latter part of the 20th century and in the early decade of the 21st century is kind of the greatest story barely told. The United States faces a fourfold threat from China. The first part is the advanced weaponry developed, a lot of it through espionage from U.S. technology. The second part is the Chinese presence in the Caribbean, which is growing very quickly. The third is China's threats to the U.S. allies, specifically the Philippines and Japan. And the fourth is the proliferation of Chinese technology, particularly nuclear technology, to other enemies of the United States, specifically Iran.
Well, you know, they are becoming more of a military threat. I think, you know, people think, and this isn't anything against the Chinese, and I'm not trying to be racist by any means, but people see China, you know, China and think of China, you know, as the old China, the old, you know, Great Wall of China, that, you know, that type era, but they are becoming more of a military threat. In fact, they just built their first aircraft carrier, and, it, you know, if I'm not mistaken, the Russians are going to supply the aircraft for it. Am I mistaken?
Well, the Chinese now do have an aircraft carrier, but that's not the only advanced weapon that they're fielding. Most people don't realize, just as you're saying, Aaron, that Chinese technology has shot ahead. For example, they have the ability to shoot U.S. satellites out of orbit, which would blind our military. They have the ability to kill our aircraft carriers and our other ships from hundreds of miles away. So we're not looking, exactly as you said, at the old China. We're looking at a brand new China with technology, most of it stolen through espionage from the United States, that is every bit our equal.
Now, if Russia does supply them with the aircraft for this carrier, like some people have suggested that they're going to purchase it from Russia, would that make them an ally of China? So, you know, God forbid if something happens with China, are we now also going against Russia, two of the most, you know, powerful countries in the world as far as military?
Aaron, it's an interesting point. Right now, I don't know if you've seen some of the news reports today, but Vladimir Putin, the head of Russia, has just been flexing his nuclear muscles yet again. So clearly, the two of them have been engaging in anti-American rhetoric. And they've been doing it to some extent in concert with one another. There's a threat there from the two of them combining their forces.
Well, what do we need to do in the United States to deflect some of this? I mean, you know, China holds the most, you know, most of our national debt more than any other country. And then, you know, we've had our tensions with Russia also. What can we do to deflect some of this?
Well, a couple of things. We have to stop signing treaties with Russia, for example, that are against the U.S. interest. The New START treaty guarantees American nuclear inferiority to the Russians for decades to come. The Russians now have a 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons against the United States. They have prevented the U.S. from deploying its anti-ballistic missile system. So we have to stop that, nip that right in the bud. We also, as far as the Chinese go, have to stop borrowing money from them. Our politicians have to learn that borrowing money to give away programs to get votes for their next election is not healthy towards the United States. And we have to look greatly at the proliferation that China is doing to other rogue nations such as Iran. I broke an exclusive story yesterday morning when I interviewed Razeh Kahili, who was a former Iranian spy master, who is discussing the possibility that the United States is engaging in one-on-one talks with Iran on ending the sanctions that are preventing Iran from getting a nuclear bomb, some of the technology which comes from China, in return for ending the sanctions. That's really not a great idea at all. The administration should not be doing that, and we should not be acting without our allies Israel and our NATO partners in doing this.
Well, that is just like a slap in the face to Israel. I mean, they are, you know, our staunchest ally in the Middle East. And to do that and to drop some of the sanctions, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu will flip out. I mean, I would if I was him.
Well, you're absolutely right, but it's not just the Israelis. It's the Europeans as well. Remember, a good portion of Europe, particularly southern and central Europe, is within range of Iranian missiles that they already have. So if we allow the Iranians to get a sufficient amount of nuclear bombs, or even one or two, they could hold Europe hostage to whatever they want.
Now, how do you think the Obama administration, you know, is with all this? I mean, to me, and, you know, I'm probably biased here, and I know I am, but with the way they handled Libya, you know, I have no confidence in this administration to do the right thing when it comes to, you know, defending Israel or, you know, talks with Iran, China militarily. I mean, what is Barack Obama going to have to do? Because in my opinion, he has absolutely no credibility.
Unfortunately, you're absolutely right, Aaron. These talks, which seem to be geared particularly towards influencing the American presidential election, really should not be going on at all. Our policy has to be that Iran should not get any further progress on nuclear development. The sanctions which the entire world imposed on Iran are just beginning to take effect in a very interesting way. You know, the people of Iran are really facing a repressive government right now, and they were beginning to oppose that government in a much more vocal way since the sanctions started taking effect. Now the Obama administration comes in, hints that it's going to dismiss the sanctions unilaterally, and it kind of does exactly the opposite of what we had hoped would occur. We had hoped we'd squeeze the Iranian leadership and eventually get some rational people in power there. Now all that progress has been thrown out of the window, basically through the ineptitude of the Obama administration.
Now with us signing the START treaty and pretty much guaranteeing that, you know, we will not use nuclear weapons against any country, does the Chinese, does the Iranians, Russians even? I mean, to me, common sense would tell you they see that more as a weakness of the United States, that they can pretty much have their way with us and that we are declining militarily and as far as defensively for the country.
Well, you have a very good point. I mean, look, the Russians have not said the same thing that we have said. We have said that we have a very high threshold. We'd only use nuclear weapons basically if they were used against us. The Russians don't believe in that. The Russians actually incorporate battlefield nuclear weapons, what we call tactical nuclear weapons, into their military planning. So they're not buying into that concept that we have. The Chinese have been developing an extensive nuclear power. We just discussed Iran. So clearly, we are projecting weakness.
Well, even their space program, China, you know, not to switch gears, but even China's space program, in 2011, they had 12 less launches than Russia did, but one more than the United States. What is China's benefit from, you know, increasing their activity in the space program? And to me, I think, again, the United States made a huge error in right now retiring the shuttle fleet when you have a country like China having one more launch than the United States, and then we are depending on Russians to get us in and out of space. How does this benefit China?
Benefits China tremendously. Going back 1,000 years of warfare, whoever owns the high ground owns the battlefield. Through the ridiculous act of ending the space shuttle program, we have conceded the high ground to our opponents. And by the way, you might be interested to know that a U.S. citizen of Chinese background, Dongfeng Cheng, was convicted recently of stealing $2 billion worth of Boeing trade secrets on how to build space shuttles.
Hmm.
Now China has a technology that we no longer use.
Wow. What, you know, Mitt Romney has said that he wants to really crack down on their espionage, their, you know, stealing their trade secrets. What will he really have to do if he does become president so that China will take us seriously? Because I'm afraid that if he does become president, that China and Russia and even Iran will try to test the new president to see how far they can get. What does he have to do from the very beginning to say, hey, I mean business, and you know, we're not going to let you continue the ways that you have been?
Well, for one thing, he has to throw a lot of the Chinese companies that are doing business in the United States out of the country. According to Article 11 of China's Constitution, any private company, so-called private company, is under the control of the Chinese government. Remember, they may look capitalist, but they're really a communist government.
Mm-hmm.
So Chinese technology companies, for example, ZTE and Hua, which is a telecommunications company, operate extensively in the United States. They operate within the government. They operate within advanced technology companies here in the States. And they steal a lot of technology from American companies and send it back to China. We have got to get them out of this country. So that's one of the first things that President Romney, potential President Romney, could do. The second thing, we have to stop the bleeding of our armed forces. In 1990, the United States had 600 ships in our Navy. Today we have 284.
Yeah.
We had 37 combat air wings in the United States Air Force. Today we have only 20. The Army had 17 divisions. Today we've got only 10. We have unilaterally disarmed over the past several years. We have got to stop that.
Well, that will, you know, just thinking here on the spot, that will just create the Pacific Ocean a playground for China. I mean, how, you know, if they are building up their military in such numbers and we're decreasing like that, I mean, who's going to stop China?
Well, you're right. In fact, several years ago, the United States Navy received an incredible shock. Our aircraft carriers are the most extensively protected ships humanity has ever seen. Yet during maneuvers in the Pacific Ocean, a Chinese submarine popped up right next to the Kitty Hawk aircraft carrier.
Hmm.
The Navy was stunned. They no longer have the guarantee that they can defend our aircraft carriers. So we have not only been losing the ball in terms of numbers, we've been losing it in terms of superior technology as well.
You know, at what point, and I, you know, I said earlier that China has, you know, they hold the most U.S. debt, and you know, maybe this is, you know, me being just Mr. Negativity, but at what point, you know, if the U.S. economy does not get better, does China decide to become the repo man and, you know, come take what they think is theirs? I mean, this has happened to countries over the vast span of history. At what point do they come decide they want to be the repo man, and would they possibly in the future invade the United States to take what they think is theirs?
Well, that's a great point. I think that point might be coming fairly close. I mean, right now, I don't think China's on the verge of doing that because we're a great cash cow for them. But I think if our economy gets to the point where we seriously can't repay the debt, then certainly something like that could occur.
You know, like I said, tomorrow's the presidential debate, and I really hope that they bring up China more than just a few sound bites, you know, just saying they're going to get tough on China because, you know, like I said, they do hold, you know, the most national debt of any country. They are growing militarily, and I believe China just wants what China thinks is theirs, and they don't really care about anybody else. So I hope it brings enough attention tomorrow to wake up some Americans and realize that the next president may have to deal with China like they're dealing with Iran, like they're dealing with Libya, so forth and so on.
You're right, and it's long overdue. We've passed the danger point. It's getting worse by the day, and it has to stop.
Well, Frank, I really appreciate you coming on the show and give us an insight on China. You are welcome back anytime, and thank you once again.
Thank you, Aaron. I look forward to speaking with you again.
Sounds great. Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Frank Vernuccio, and you know he is an expert on China, on foreign relations, and you know as he said, he is, you know he mentioned that China is building up militarily. You know they are increasing their navy and their armed forces more than the Americans are. Now, if you want to call into the show, give us a call, 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. You can go live on the air. Join us on our chat room in blogtalkradio.com/AaronMcCrady. Got a chat going on there. But, you know, we have got to get serious in this country about foreign policy. You know, we live in a world today that we have Twitter, we have Facebook, you know, the internet, email. We no longer live in a world where we can just build up walls and be content that, you know, what goes on in this country stays in this country and there's no other repercussions. You know, all it takes is for some goon overseas that thinks that the world is his with a Hitler-type mentality to push a button and whole cities are destroyed. You know, I believe in American exceptionalism. I believe that America is the greatest country on the face of the earth, the greatest country in history. And think of it like you think of sports. You know, everybody aims for the person that's on top. Everybody wants to take down that person. You know, if you're this little small country, you know, Barack Obama himself called Iran, oh, we don't need to worry about them. They're a tiny little country. Well, they're on the brink of getting nuclear weapons, Mr. President. We need to, you know, we need to think, okay, maybe they want to be the underdog. Maybe they want to topple the United States. Like Appalachian State toppled Michigan a few years ago. You know, who wouldn't want to topple the United States if you had that type of mentality? Rather, seeing us as an ally and a country that could really help, they want to go down and topple the United States. That's why in this Twitter society, in this Facebook society, the internet society and culture that we live in, that's why foreign policy is important. That's why tomorrow night at 9 o'clock from Boca Raton, Florida, when we watch that debate, we really need to listen to their answers. What will Barack Obama say about China? What will he say about Libya? What will Mitt Romney say about China? What will Mitt Romney say about Libya? What will go on, you know, between the two? You have two different philosophies there. I mean, look at Libya. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later on with Jack Caravelli. Look at Libya. More and more comes out each day about the assassination of our ambassador there, Ambassador Stevens, and the other Americans. You know, why is it that an American ambassador overseas can be fearful of his staff, of his embassy, of his own life, and tell the United States government, hey, we need some help, we need some protection, and the United States government only gives them one armed guard, 646-200-3400, if you want to join the show. You know, what happened to protecting our own overseas? I mean, if you have a passport, go look in your passport, and you will see. You open up your passport, and I do not have it right here in front of me, so you know you're going to have to forgive me if I misstate this or if I don't say it word for word. But inside your passport, in the United States passport, it says the country, pretty much the country that this person is in, guarantees them safe passage. Declared by the Secretary of State of the United States. What happens if you don't get safe passage? What's the United States government going to do? Who has the confidence that if you get in a bind, that your country is going to be there to support you? I mean, my goodness, we have a United States ambassador overseas that was assassinated in cold blood. And our country did not give him the protection. Our country said it was because of some video. And for 2 weeks, they kept making us think it was because of this video. But instead, it was an attack orchestrated on 9/11 to celebrate the anniversary of 9/11. And it took the administration 2 weeks to admit that. And they still don't want to talk about it. They knew in 24 hours that it was terrorist. That it was terrorism. They knew within 24 hours that we were attacked. You know, what is the difference between us being attacked on our own soil and us being attacked in a country at our embassy that represents in other countries democracy, the freedom, the ideals of the United States of America? And the top person in that country, the top American diplomat in that country, gets assassinated, gets drugged out of the embassy, drugged through the streets. That's exactly what happened. And I don't want you to go look at this on YouTube, but you can go see it on YouTube. Ambassador Stevens being drugged through the street, dying. And what does this administration do? Absolutely nothing. You know, Frank Venuccio just said, you know, how can, you know, I asked him, how can people take us seriously with the Obama administration when they've really botched up Libya? I mean, was it their mentality that they didn't want to stir up any more trouble for more attacks? I mean, I don't know. Nobody really knows anything because the administration is tight-lipped. You know, that's why foreign policy is important. It is so, so important. You know, people fly back and forth. We have trade back and forth. 646-200-3400, if you want to call the show. You know, people fly back and forth from country to country. People buy goods and services from other countries. Like I said, the days that, you know, it took months to get a message across to another country, months to get goods and services, those days are gone. I mean, what are we going to do? You know, we have China that is manipulating their dollar to take advantage of the United States. The United States looks like fools. We need to get tough on China, but who's talking about China? Nobody. Do you hear them in the media? No. When are you going to hear them in the media? When it's too late. When China decides, you know, the United States owes us all this money, and seeing how the United States militarily is declining, and seeing how we are increasing militarily, I wonder what could happen if maybe we just went over and bombed a city. You don't think it could happen? You know, ask the Polish people in World War II if it can happen. Ask the Jews in World War II if it can happen. A little bit scary, huh? And when the Chinese, when they will have more ships in 2015 than the United States will, and they're patrolling the Pacific Ocean. We're in trouble. we will be in trouble. You know, we really need to, as a nation, get it together with defense spending. You know, the military needs the tools to deter attacks and enhance diplomatic efforts. You know, what if we do get in conflict with China and talks fail? What are we going to do? We can't just, you know, turn the other way and run. If they attack us, what are we going to do? And then we sign this stupid START treaty, making us just sitting ducks. You know, by gosh, I'll tell you, if I was president of the United States, and who knows, maybe I will be one day. But if I was president of the United States, and I thought American lives were on the line, or there was a chance, and it was inevitable, that a country was going to destroy us, I would consider using nuclear weapons to protect American lives. But no, we can't do that anymore. Unless something's used against us first, we can't use nuclear weapons. Until millions of Americans die, we can't use nuclear weapons. Until cities are vaporized. And like in Japan, when we dropped the bomb, shadows were burnt into the walls. Until that happens here, well, we can't use nuclear weapons. What sense does that make? You know, the Navy in the United States is being tasked with more responsibilities than ever. You know, they're being asked to secure vital sea lanes worth over $14 trillion annually, but with less. They're trying to do more with less. 646-200-3400 if you want to join the show. But we have the Chinese that's growing their military by leaps and bounds. They just got an aircraft carrier for the first time. They launched in 2011 one more shuttle mission than the United States. And then what do? We end our shuttle program. We're dependent on the Russians, which the Russians are actually going to supply with, you know, China's going to buy it from Russia, but Russia is still going to supply the planes to be put on this aircraft carrier for China. And if China is in with the Russians and the United States, we're dependent on the Russians to go to space because we're so smart that we ended our space program. Well, we didn't end our space program. We ended the shuttle program, which was the only way right now we have to get to space ourselves. We ended that. So now if we get into a tiff with China or Russia, what's going to happen? We've got Americans in space right now. We're just going to leave them there? I mean, I know that, you know, the private sector, you know, we're developing technologies to get to space and have manned missions, but we're not there yet. Why couldn't we wait a few years, keep a couple shuttles for ourselves in the government in the event something happened? That's the military for you. But then the government for you. But then we want that same government that has the insight to do that to run our health care. I don't understand. You know, despite all those threats, the Barack Obama administration has lowered the defense budget baseline by $750 billion, billion with a B, dollars over a 10-year period when you calculate in the defense budget request in fiscal year 2011. It makes absolutely no sense. China's a growing military power. And we cut our defense budgets. Our military is shrinking. You know, we're getting ready to take a news break. And after the news, we're going to talk with a friend of the show, Jack Caravelli, once again. You know, with the presidential debate coming up tomorrow and focusing on foreign affairs, you know, we just talked to Frank Vernuccio about China. We're going to focus on here in a few minutes. Iran, Libya, you know, the consequences we face if we don't act intelligently. We're going to take a news break. We'll be right back in a few minutes.
News Radio. I'm Lisa Lissandra. A deadly day at a spa in a suburb of Milwaukee. Three people shot dead, four wounded, one critically. Police saying the shooting was related to a domestic dispute.
I can confirm that the suspect in the shooting matter, Mr. Radcliffe F. Houghton, has been found in the salon. It appears that he is deceased of a self-induced gunshot wound.
Brookfield Police Chief Daniel Tusshouse.
I want to assure the public that all is well, it is safe. The only individual we were seeking in this matter has been found, and we believe him to be deceased by a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
Police say the investigation was hampered by an explosive device that was inside the building. President Obama and Mitt Romney in their final debate tomorrow night. This one will focus on foreign policy. Obama's senior advisor David Axelrod is slamming Romney for what some call gaffes in dealing with other nations.
He was wrong on Libya. He was wrong on Iraq. You know, people can have a chance to take a measure of these two guys and say, who do I want as the commander-in-chief?
On NBC's Meet the Press.
I hope that the president will be pressed on what his plans are for the next 4 years on foreign policy and, if possible, on the economy. I know that's not the topic, but they are related.
Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio on CBS's Face the Nation. The price of gas dipping nearly 9 cents over the past 2 weeks. The average now $3.75 a gallon.
We have the results on the street now from those oil price drops. We also have lower seasonal demand after summertime.
Oil industry analyst Trilby Lundberg, Tulsa with the lowest price at $3.26, San Francisco with the highest at $4.51. 11 suspected al-Qaeda-linked militants arrested in Jordan for planning to attack shopping malls and Western diplomatic missions there. A government spokesman says all suspects are Jordanian and remain in custody. You're listening to Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
When you're on the go and need to know, it's Fox News Radio, live, anytime, anyplace. And it's as easy as foxnewsradio.com. Listen to the most recent newscast or your favorite Fox talk personalities. Just go to foxnewsradio.com or download the Fox News Channel app for news, video, weather, and Fox News talk from one app on iPhone, iPad, Android, Windows Phone, and more. Go to foxnews.com/mobile. Stay connected to Fox News and Fox News Radio.
It's been called shell shock, war neurosis, and battle fatigue. Today, we call it post-traumatic stress disorder, and it affects one out of every five warriors returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support for warriors with PTSD and all other scars of war, whether those scars are visible or hidden. Find out how to help, because for warriors, the greatest casualty is being forgotten. Please visit WoundedWarriorProject.org.
President Obama says he was a statesman of great conscience and conviction who dedicated his life to serving the country he loved. Former South Dakota Senator George McGovern has died at age 90.
George McGovern will long be remembered as an orator for peace. As a senator, McGovern would become known for his growing contempt for the Vietnam War. As the years dragged on, he would become more and more adamant that the solution for Vietnam was political and not military. In fact, by 1972, as McGovern accepted the Democratic nomination for president, his platform revolved around an appeal of withdrawal from Vietnam.
And I want that war closed.
But what was little known until years later was that McGovern himself was a decorated veteran who flew 35 B-24 bombing missions during World War II.
Fox's Brett Baer. Reverend Jesse Jackson says his son, Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., will return to the Mayo Clinic for a checkup. The younger Jackson left the clinic last month after seeking treatment for bipolar disorder. He's been on medical leave from Congress since June. As the fighting in Syria continues, the economy in that country worsens.
A recent UN food security assessment in Syria shows inflation has risen dramatically. Spokesman Jens Laerke says prices for staple foods such as milk, meat, and poultry have gone up as high as 300% in certain places.
Cost of apartments, the rental cost of apartments has in some areas tripled over the past 3 months. That unemployment rose from 8.6 in 2010 to 14.9 in 2011, so a steep upward trend.
Laerke says all these factors, combined with the ongoing hostilities, are having severe humanitarian consequences for Syrian civilians. In Geneva, Kate Alexander, Fox News Radio.
Paranormal Activity debuts at number one at the box office. Lisa LaSera, Fox News Radio.
We would like to welcome you. This is only just begun.
He has the ability. He has the technology. He has the desire. Aaron McCready. He's ready to rip it up.
This is amazing stuff.
Are you ready for him?
Do it. Do it.
Make some noise! Aaron McCready. Let go.
From time to time, we've been tempted to believe that society has become too complex to be managed by self-rule. That government by an elite group is superior to government for, by, and of the people. But if no one among us is capable of governing himself, then who among us has the capacity to govern someone else? We're not, as some would have us believe, to an inevitable decline. It is time to check and reverse the growth of government, which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed. Can we solve the problems confronting us? Well, the answer is an unequivocal and emphatic yes. And after all, why shouldn't we believe that? We are Americans.
Welcome back to the program, everyone. I am Aaron McCready, and if you're just joining us, you missed Frank Vernuccio. We were talking about China and ahead of our presidential debate tomorrow. They're focusing on foreign policy. But I have got another guest for you talking about the same issues, foreign policy, and ahead of our debate tomorrow. But he is a great friend of the show, and you guys know him, that are regular listeners. And he was with the CIA starting in 1982. Then he moved to the White House National Security Council staff from 96 to 2000, where he served as a senior career officer, and he was responsible for the U.S. non-proliferation policy in the Middle East and Russia. And then he became Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy from 2000 to 2005, directing the department's international threat reduction programs. Jack Caravelli, welcome once again back to the show.
Aaron, thank you very much, of course, and good evening to you and your listeners.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, starting right away, what do you hope tomorrow, since they are focusing on foreign policy, that the candidates really talk about and the issues of the day?
Well, I think where the debate will head, and I know you were in your last segment talking about China, which I certainly think will be sort of on the agenda tomorrow night, but I think the real key is going to be focusing on the controversies that surround the recent and tragic events in Libya, as well as the bloody civil war in Syria, the enormous problems we still have with Iran in its pursuit of a nuclear weapons capability, and I think those issues will very much fill the docket and probably be rounded out by the such easy topics as terrorism and energy independence. So it should be a rollicking debate, and one hopes that the format and the participants, of course, really bring some substance to these issues that are really of just enormously great significance to the American public and American interests right now.
You did mention Libya, and you know, recently, since we talked last, Hillary Clinton came out and took the blame, since she is Secretary of State, for what happened in Libya. You worked directly for Bill Clinton in the White House when he was president. You know, and you probably had encounters with Hillary. She is not a stupid person, and she's very political savvy. You know, to me, the buck stops with the president. Why would she, as Secretary of State, take the ultimate blame for what happened in the tragic events in Libya and the assassination of the ambassador?
Well, Aaron, you know, first, I agree with you on both points. The buck does stop with the White House, with the president. She carries out his foreign policy, and I certainly agree that Mrs. Clinton is a highly intelligent woman. I think a couple of things go to your question. The first is that I think it is pretty clear now that, you know, was the State Department in sort of an operational way that received and bungled or did not answer or respond to the requests from Ambassador Stevens and his regional security officer who worked at the embassy with him on at least one or two occasions and maybe more, asking for more security from the State Department and perhaps from the Department of Defense, given the situation in Libya. Now, it does not take any, you know, special intelligence, you know, to have known, and I'm sure this was what was driving the ambassador and his security officer's requests, to know that in the months leading up to the, again, tragic September attacks that killed the officer and killed the ambassador, that there had been a number of violent incidents in the Benghazi area, including against the British ambassador, that certainly, I think, pointed in only one, you know, direction. You know, that is a very dangerous area, and I think that was what the security officer and what the ambassador were responding to when they asked for assistance from the State Department. That assistance clearly never came. So in that sense, you know, again, in sort of an operational sense, you know, the burden falls on the State Department, and shame on them for that. They should have responded. But I think even broader, you know, I think this also points to a larger administration policy failing that throughout the entire region. You know, it is very hard for me to see that there has been much of a broader grand strategy that we have really been able to formulate and implement, given the massive changes that have been taking place under our nose, including in Egypt, which we haven't even mentioned, since this so-called start of the Arab Spring, which is really goes back to January 2011. So there was an immediate problem and shortfall and I think terrible mistake made at the State Department, but there's a larger policy gap, I think, that really sources back to the White House.
Is this the nail in the coffin for the Obama administration? Have they defeated themselves with this?
Well, I think they've, I don't know, I guess we'll find out in November when the American public makes that determination, the voters. But I think what it points to, again, Aaron, is, you know, we have suffered mightily by an administration that really cannot think cohesively and in a long-term way. You know, they represent today a nation that has incredibly broad and global interests, not only in security areas, but also obviously in trade and communications, and the world is changing enormously fast, and our policies, sadly, have not kept up with changes, have not anticipated changes, and have not figured out ways to deal with the changes that are unfolding, you know, every day in front of our eyes. And I regret saying that, but I think that, you know, if the debate does nothing else, I hope it will shed light on what, you know, President Obama thinks or doesn't think is the path, you know, to really lead America in a way that secures its interests, advances its interests, again, not only political but economic as well, in a rapidly changing global environment. And I think that will be something I hope your listeners will look and listen to very closely tomorrow night.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to join the show, 646-200-3400, you'll go live on the air and we'll answer questions for you. And ladies and gentlemen, I just want to mention that, you know, Jack Caravelli is coming from a point that, you know, he worked for the Clinton and the Bush administration, so he is not coming from a biased viewpoint. I mean, what he's saying just is absolutely spot on. And, you know, before we get into Syria, I just want to get your take on this, because this, you know, you did work you know, U.S. non-proliferation policy. And, you know, in 2009, Obama outlined when he was in Prague that he wanted a world free of nuclear weapons. And then he also issued in 2010 a nuclear posture review report. And the idea was not to use nuclear weapons on a country. I mean, does this make us look weak to our enemies that we have a U.S. president that unless we are attacked, that, you know, we will not use nuclear weapons? And I understand nuclear weapons is a very bad thing, but, I mean, what does that say to our enemies?
Well, Aaron, it's a terribly important but also a very complex question. I think, again, this month, I think we're in the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which some of your audience and listeners will remember really brought us closer to the brink of nuclear war than maybe any time since the start of the nuclear age, and we got past that. But I think, look, what the president, as I understand it, aspires to is noble. And again, as you recall, and your listeners will know, it was a large reason that he won the Nobel Peace Prize in a way that it was perhaps not well deserved. But it is a noble aspiration to have a world without nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, to me, and I judge myself maybe what I'll call a conservative realist, is that, nuclear weapons, serve a very useful and certainly during the Cold War an important deterrent function, to try to prevent the outbreak of war. And the fact that we have been, through our, history since World War II, a strong nuclear weapons state, I think in a number of cases, has served the interests of peace very well. It sounds paradoxical, it's ironic, but I think in a world where there are many nations, and I think this is part of your question, still a number of nations that wish us ill, the phrase, peace through strength, still resonates with me, and I think is a way to, again, protect and advance not only our national interests, but the national interests of our friends, both in the Middle East and Asia as well. I think the fact of U.S. nuclear power and the U.S. nuclear umbrella really has kept a number of friendly states from pursuing their own nuclear weapons policies or capabilities, including important countries such as Japan. So, perhaps in 100 years or more, we will have a world where, the large portions of the world really share the vision of, of a world without nuclear weapons. But until we reach that point, I put myself in the camp that says that we need to continue remaining strong in capabilities across the board, working to, try to reduce the number of nuclear weapons and the like, and trying to pursue policies, such as we'll probably discuss in a minute, of keeping nations, again, particularly those that wish us ill, from becoming nuclear weapon states. But so I guess the idealist in me applauds what the president was saying, but the realist in me thinks that it is at best a wish and something that, just is not a realistic policy approach in still a very, very difficult world to deal in many regions. And, that's why I hope that, whoever, wins the White House in November, will maintain a strong nuclear deterrent posture.
Obama, tomorrow, he's going to attack himself on foreign policy as far as killing bin Laden, ending the war in Iraq, bringing the troops home in Afghanistan. But when it comes down to relationships with other countries, I think this president falls short. Just for example, he can visit New York City and to go speak to the UN, and while he's in town, can go on The View. But yet he doesn't have time to sit down and talk with one of our staunchest allies in the Middle East and talk to Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, behind the scenes, do people think that this president is weak and it is time for a change in leadership? I mean, what do we have to do, especially with Israel, to back them up and support them in the face of nuclear war with Iran?
Aaron, you've raised an incredibly important issue. I think the general consensus among both the supporters and opponents of the president is exactly what you laid out, that this president has very few, if any, real, good, useful, and strong personal relationships with any of the national leaders or international leaders he deals with, whether it's our adversaries or our friends. We do not have a good relationship with the British. He does not have a good personal relationship by far with, as you mentioned, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. He has very poor relations, if any, with the Russians, with the Chinese. These, whether we like them or not, or agree with their policies, we have strong interests. And across the board, this is a president who has not forged relationships. And I think if life shows us anything, it's that relationships matter, they count. But, you know, I can't say personally I'm surprised by this, because this is a man who came to the White House with very little, if any, foreign policy experience. He was, as you know, a community organizer in Chicago, which is fine, a great thing for Chicago, I guess. And then he served just a few years in the United States Senate. But this is a man who, you know, his worldview is very, very limited. His experience on the world stage is very, very limited. And he has treated it almost as if he's walking by the common cold and trying not to catch it. And I find that it's not only unfortunate, but again to your very good point, it weakens us, you know, in the way that the world sees us. And that's critical, because, you know, we have our views of the world, of course, but the world does watch us. And I travel a lot overseas, and you always get the sense that, you know, we are being judged, for better or worse, again, by friends and adversaries. And this is a president that has not established himself really as a global leader in any realistic sense, beginning with, to the heart of your question, not establishing good relationships. And his lack of performance at the United Nations last month, as you mentioned, is a prime example of that. And rather than being on The View, he should have been face-to-face with, again, both friends and adversaries, and trying to advance U.S. interests.
You know, switching gears over to Syria, I mean, what in the world are we doing? I mean, we're not doing a single thing to help the citizens of that country out. I mean, you know, they're killing their own people, and then here we are, the United States, that's supposed to have the high moral authority of the world, but like you said, people watch us and people look up to us. What in the world's going on? Why are we not doing more?
Well, it's a great question, Aaron. The fact in my view is we should be doing more. Syria, sadly, has become a bloodbath. It is a civil war by any definition. There have been probably at least 35, 40,000 deaths. President Assad in Syria is butchering his own people. It has triggered in a massive refugee problem that has spilled over into other nations, including Turkey and Jordan. And as you said, we have done virtually nothing. Now, it is a very complex situation, because some of those opposed to Assad are radical elements themselves. And, you know, we do not know, you know, exactly who we should support with perhaps lethal equipment such as military arms. But having said that, you know, where I think we really come up short is we should be devoting resources and our intelligence and our diplomacy to answering that very question. Who are the groups opposed to Assad, you know, that will stand up and are not do not have their own radical agenda, but really want to restore Syria to a more peaceful and hopefully democratic nation that, of course, it has not been, you know, for decades. So, you know, we are not trying to answer the hard questions. Obama seems to have thrown up his hands and said, it's too hard, I can't figure this out. But I think the more moral as well as strategic approach would be to say, yes, it is very difficult, we may make mistakes, but if we are not involved in trying to find a solution, when there is a solution, we will be left on the sidelines, and that will be to our great shame. And again, to the point you made earlier, you know, the world is watching, and the Arab world will see that we, you know, almost literally did nothing when Syrian people, good, honest, decent people, were being butchered by their government. So I have great concerns about the lack of administration effort in this, and I hope that Governor Romney brings that to the attention of the American public tomorrow night.
Now, do you think that because our failure to do anything, that has actually hurting us with the citizens of those that country and the countries around. And the reason I ask this is because I used to work with a lady a few years ago, and she was from Bosnia. And when I would talk to her about politics and she would mention Bill Clinton, her face would light up. And, I mean, you would have thought that, you know, Bill Clinton hung the moon for her, because she said that, you know, he saved her country and saved her family by helping that country out. Are we doing more damage as far as people seeing the United States by our inaction and not helping Syria?
Well, I think the short answer is you're right, Aaron. I think, you know, if we don't change course, either through an election change or the administration, this administration really coming to its own decisions to engage, that, you know, we will be looked on in, you know, weeks and months and years to come by the Arab world as really having failed them. You know, we can and we do and we should be supportive of Israel, the only real democracy in the region. But at the same time, I think we have large interests of our own in supporting the moderate Arab world. And I think as the Arab nations and important nations such as Turkey, you know, watch us, I think the current judgment along the lines of what you're saying is that the United States just, you know, we didn't show up. And, you know, it's very much the same in Libya. Now, I am not implying that, you know, we should, you know, send military forces in or have boots on the ground, as they say. But there are many more things we can do without putting U.S. soldiers at risk in another conflict that really would show that we're committed to trying to do what we can to end this bloody, this terrible butchering of thousands of people and lead to a better day. And we do that both for humanitarian grounds, but again, back to the conservative realist that I hope I am, but also because it's in our interests to try to find areas of stability in a very fragile and unstable region.
You worked in the CIA for many years. What, if anything, do you think that the CIA is doing? Are they doing anything covertly in Syria to help the situation, unbeknownst to the president, since the president evidently has turned a blind eye? Do you think they're doing anything?
Well, you know, I can only speculate because I don't work there now, and of course I don't speak for the organization in any way. Number one, I certainly hope that the agency is not doing anything that's not approved and supported by the policy side. The intelligence folks, of course, work for the policymakers and, you know, should carry out their directives, obviously within the extent of the law and ethics. You know, what I've seen in press reporting indicates that, you know, intelligence elements are, you know, are limited on the ground and trying to do some of the things that we've talked about of assessing who the different opposition groups are, what their long-term intentions are, what their agenda is. But I think the record, Aaron, is that the commitment of resources along those lines, diplomatic and intelligence, in Syria and around Syria, has really been very, very limited, you know, compared to, I think, what we could do and what we should do. So I think the administration, I think, owes an explanation to the American public, you know, about why they're not using non-lethal resources to try to really engage, understand the situation better, and then, again, bring, hopefully, forceful policies that will, you know, make a material difference, you know, for the people in Syria and again, for the stability of the entire region.
And one final question before I let you go. You know, in regards to the UN, you know, I know the United States, we're really not doing anything, but where is the UN on this? Where are they? You know, I know that you know former UN Ambassador John Bolton, and, you know, he has ties to the UN. What in the world is the UN doing? Because from my viewpoint, just an outsider looking in, when the UN fails to do anything with this and some of the policy they have towards some of the other countries, I mean, it is almost like that the United Nations has been turned into a Mickey Mouse organization. Where are they at with Syria?
Well, I think, Aaron, there are a lot of reasons to have great concerns about the effectiveness of the United Nations, and that goes back for decades, and I think Ambassador Bolton would agree with me very much on that. But I think to your question, the UN can pass resolutions, but one of the real limits of the Security Council, although some would also say it's a strength, is that in terms of Security Council resolutions that have real bite, that have effectiveness, you need to have it passed by the permanent, all the permanent members need to support it or abstain. And in the Syria case, both Russia and China, who are permanent members of the Security Council, as you know, they can and have vetoed resolutions that would have at least provided some opportunities to, you know, take on this issue more directly. The veto power, again, from any of the Security Council permanent members, kills a resolution. We've used our veto at times in the past as well. But I think that, you know, again, this administration, realizing where the international community is, has sort of tied its own hands because of Russia and China, needs to make its own decisions about, you know, what is in its interest, what is the moral thing to do. And again, as I was saying, the moral thing in this case is to really begin to bring much more forceful diplomacy, if you will, intelligence, support, supply of armaments, to well-recognized opposition forces, and send a message to Assad that, you know, his days are numbered, and his best opportunity is to leave the scene and allow better days to return for the people in Syria.
Well, Jack Caravelli, thank you so much for your insight. And again, I always say this to you, but you truly are a good friend to the show, and I appreciate your insight. I'm sure our listeners do, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Aaron, it's always a pleasure, and have a good evening, and certainly the same to your listeners.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Jack Caravelli, foreign policy expert. He worked directly for Bill Clinton in the White House and for George W. Bush. So he is coming with that viewpoint, you know, not with any political motives, not from a Democratic or Republican standpoint, but truly from a person that has really been inside the government. If you want to call into the show, 646-200-3400. We ran over just a little bit, so we will be ending the show here in a few minutes. But, you know, it is so important as you listen to the debates tomorrow, as you listen to President Obama and Governor Romney debate, you know, it does matter about foreign policy. We don't live in a Twitter world anymore. We do live in a Twitter world. We're not shut off by big walls. It is important about foreign policy. It is important how the world sees us. We need to be seen as the moral authority of the world. When governments murder their own people like they're doing in Syria, thousands upon thousands, we need to go in and help those citizens. We are the best country in the world, the best country in the history of the world. And I think the past 4 years we have declined in that. You know, as you watch the debates tomorrow, really focus in on that. Who's going to have the better answers? Is Obama going to be taken to task for his responses in Libya? Is that the nail in the coffin for him? You know, we need to really listen. It's the last presidential debate tomorrow. And then 2 weeks from Tuesday, we're going to elect a new president. We need to decide if it's going to be 4 more years of the same, or if it's going to be a new person in office. Well, we'll see. We will see. We're getting ready to end the show here in a minute, but, you know, it is important that we take interest in the policies and politics of the United States. It's going to affect you one day. Your taxes, the way the world sees us. Everybody's aiming for us. We're the number one. Just like in sports, everybody goes for the person at the top, and we're at the top, and everybody's aiming for us. We've got a show coming up. Two more shows this week. 8 o'clock on Wednesday and 8 o'clock on Thursday. We have quite a bit of Georgia listeners. Quite a few. And this show has reached out. There's to the Chris Boddicker and Scott Holcomb campaigns here in Georgia. They are really going at it for State House. And we've reached out to both of them, and so hopefully we will hear something back. Because it is only, you know, fair to the Georgia listeners to hear what they have to say. So we'll see if we hear something from those campaigns. But if we don't hear anything, we'll have great guests as we always do, national guests. The show will start at 8 o'clock on Wednesday and 8 o'clock on Thursday. And then one last thing, and I always say this, I know if you're unemployed, it's tough out there, but your job now is to find a job. You know, this is the United States of America. We've been through tougher times than this. I know it may seem like the end of the world for you, but we'll get through this. Keep your head up, stay strong, and we will make it through. That's why it's so important we really pay attention to this campaign. You know, your new job is to find a job. Maybe you need to find something that maybe isn't in your area of expertise, that maybe you think is not becoming of you. But at least you have a job, and there's nothing wrong with that. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a great honor and pleasure to be with you this evening. I would like to thank my guests Frank Vernuccio and Jack Caravelli, and we will see you Wednesday night. Have a great night.